England Before the Reformation. Chapter 13. The Wolves. It is occasionally necessary to soften down the somewhat exaggerated colors in which contemporary writers describe the Romish clergy, but there are certain appellations which history is bound to accept. The Wolves, for so the priests were called, by attacking the lords and commons had attempted a work beyond their reach. They turned their wrath on others. There were many shepherds endeavoring to gather together the sheep of the Lord beside the peaceful waters. These must be frightened, and the sheep driven into the howling wilderness. The Wolves, determined to fall upon the Lollards. There lived in London an honest tradesman named Richard Hun, one of those witnesses of the truth who, sincere though unenlightened, have been often found in the bosom of Catholicism. It was his practice to retire to his closet and spend a portion of each day in the study of the Bible. At the death of one of his children, the priest required of him an exorbitant fee, which Hun refused to pay, and for which he was summoned before the legate's court. Animated by that public spirit which characterizes the people of England, he felt indignant that an Englishman should be cited before a foreign tribunal, and laid an information against the priest and his council under the act of proemunire. Such boldness, most extraordinary at that time, exasperated the clergy beyond all bounds. "If these proud citizens are allowed to have their way," exclaimed the monks, "every layman will dare to resist a priest." Exertions were accordingly made to snare the pretended rebel in the trap of heresy. He was thrown into the Lollard's Tower at St. Paul's, and an iron collar was fastened round his neck, attached to which was a chain so heavy that neither man nor beast, says Fox, would have been able to bear it long. When taken before his judges, they could not convict him of heresy, and it was observed with astonishment that he had his beads in prison with him. They would have set him at liberty, after inflicting on him perhaps some trifling penance, but then, what a bad example it would be, and who could stop the reformers, if it was so easy to resist the papacy? Unable to triumph by justice, certain fanatics resolved to triumph by crime. At midnight on the December 2nd, the day of his examination, three men stealthily ascended the stairs of the Lollard's Tower. The bell ringer went first, carrying a torch. A sergeant named Charles Joseph followed, and last came the bishop's chancellor. Having entered the cell, they went up to the bed on which Hun was lying, and finding that he was asleep, the chancellor said, "Lay hands on the thief." Charles Joseph and the bellringer fell upon the prisoner, who, awaking with a start, saw at a glance what this midnight visit meant. He resisted the assassins at first, but was soon overpowered and strangled. Charles Joseph then fixed the dead man's belt round his neck. The bellringer helped to raise his lifeless body, and the chancellor slipped the other end of the belt through a ring fixed in the wall. They then placed his cap on his head and hastily quitted the cell. Immediately after, the conscience-stricken Charles Joseph got on horseback and rode from the city. The bellringer left the cathedral and hid himself. The crime dispersed the criminals. The chancellor alone kept his ground, and he was at prayers when the news was brought him that the turnkey had found Hun hanging. "He must have killed himself in despair," said the hypocrite. But everyone knew poor Hun's Christian feelings. "It is the priests who have murdered him," was the general cry in London, and an inquest was ordered to be held on his body. On Tuesday, the 5th of December, William Barnwell, the city coroner, the two sheriffs, and 24 jurymen, proceeded to the Lollard's Tower. They remarked that the belt was so short that the head could not be got out of it, and that consequently it had never been placed in it voluntarily, and hence the jury concluded that the suspension was an afterthought of some other persons. Moreover, they found that the ring was too high for the poor victim to reach it, that the body bore marks of violence, and that traces of blood were to be seen in the cell. "Wherefore all we find by God and all our consciences," runs the verdict, "that Richard Hun was murdered. Also we acquit the said Richard Hun of his own death." It was but too true, and the criminals themselves confessed it. The miserable Charles Joseph, having returned home on the evening of the December 6th, said to his maidservant, "If you will swear to keep my secret, I will tell you all."
"Yes, master," she replied,
"if it is neither felony nor treason." Joseph took a book, swore the girl on it, and then said to her, "I have killed Richard Hun."
"O master, how?"
"He was called a worthy man. I would rather than £100 that were not done," he made answer. "But what is done cannot be undone." He then rushed out of the house. The clergy foresaw what a serious blow this unhappy affair would be to them, and to justify themselves they examined Hun's Bible. It was Wycliffe's version, and having read in the preface that
Poor men and idiots, simple folks, have the truth of the Holy Scriptures more than 1,000 prelates and religious men and clerks of the school, and further that. The Pope ought to be called Antichrist. The Bishop of London, assisted by the bishops of Durham and Lincoln, declared Hun guilty of heresy, and on the December 20th his dead body was burnt at Smithfield. Hun's bones have been burnt, and therefore he was a heretic, said the priests. He was a heretic, and therefore he committed suicide. The triumph of the clergy was of short duration, for almost at the same time William Horsey, the bishop's chancellor, Charles Joseph, and John Spalding the bellringer, were convicted of the murder. A bill passed the Commons restoring Hun's property to his family and vindicating his character. The lords accepted the bill, and the king himself said to the priests, "Restore to these wretched children the property of their father, whom you so cruelly murdered, to our great and just horror. If the clerical theocracy should gain the mastery of the state," was the general remark in London, "it would not only be a very great lie, but the most frightful tyranny." England has never gone back since that time, and a theocratic rule has always inspired the sound portion of the nation with a just and insurmountable antipathy. Such were the events taking place in England shortly before the Reformation. This was not all. The clergy had not been fortunate in Hun's affair, but they were not for that reason unwilling to attempt a new one. In the spring of 1517, the year in which Luther posted up his theses, a priest, whose manners announced a man swollen with pride, happened to be on board the passage boat from London to Gravesend with an intelligent and pious Christian of Ashford by name John Brown. The passengers, as they floated down the stream, were amusing themselves by watching the banks glide away from them, when the priest, turning towards Brown, said to him insolently, "You are too near me, get farther off. Do you know who I am?"
"No, sir," answered Brown.
"Well, then you must know that I am a priest."
"Indeed, sir. Are you a parson or vicar or a lady's chaplain?"
"No, I am a soul priest," he haughtily replied.
"I sing mass to save souls."
"Do you, sir?" rejoined Brown somewhat ironically.
"That is well done. And can you tell me where you find the soul when you begin the mass?"
"I cannot," said the priest.
"And where you leave it when the mass is ended?"
"I do not know."
"What?
What?" continued Brown with marks of astonishment. "You do not know where you find the soul or where you leave it, and yet you say that you save it."
"Go thy ways," said the priest angrily. "Thou art a heretic, and I will be even with thee." Thenceforward the priest and his neighbor conversed no more together. At last they reached Gravesend and the boat anchored. As soon as the priest had landed, he hastened to two of his friends, Walter and William Moore, and all three mounting their horses set off for Canterbury, and denounced Brown to the archbishop. In the meantime John Brown had reached home. 3 days later, his wife, Elizabeth, who had just left her chamber, went to church, dressed all in white, to return thanks to God for delivering her in the perils of childbirth. Her husband, assisted by her daughter Alice and the maidservant, were preparing for their friends the feast usual on such occasions, and they had all of them taken their seats at table, joy beaming on every face, when the street door was abruptly opened, and Chilton, the constable, a cruel and savage man, accompanied by several of the archbishop's apparitors, seized upon the worthy townsman. All sprang from their seats in alarm. Elizabeth and Alice uttered the most heartrending cries, but the primate's officers, without showing any emotion, pulled Brown out of the house, and placed him on horseback, tying his feet under the animal's belly. It is a serious matter to jest with a priest. The cavalcade rode off quickly, and Brown was thrown into prison, and there left 40 days. At the end of this time, the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Bishop of Rochester called before them the impudent fellow who doubted whether a priest's mass could save souls, and required him to retract this blasphemy. But Brown, if he did not believe in the mass, believed in the gospel. "Christ was once offered," he said, "to take away the sins of many. It is by this sacrifice we are saved, and not by the repetitions of the priests." At this reply the archbishop made a sign to the executioners, one of whom took off the shoes and stockings of this pious Christian, while the other brought in a pan of burning coals, upon which they set the martyr's feet. The English laws in truth forbade torture to be inflicted on any subject of the crown, but the clergy thought themselves above the laws. "Confess the efficacy of the mass," cried the two bishops to poor Brown. "If I deny my Lord upon earth," he replied,
He will deny me before his Father in heaven. The flesh was burned off the soles of the feet even to the bones, and still John Brown remained unshaken. The bishops therefore ordered him to be given over to the secular arm that he might be burnt alive. On the Saturday preceding the festival of Pentecost, in the year 1517, the martyr was led back to Ashford, where he arrived just as the day was drawing to a close. A number of idle persons were collected in the street, and among them was Brown's maidservant, who ran off crying to the house, and told her mistress, "I have seen him, he was bound, and they were taking him to prison." Elizabeth hastened to her husband and found him sitting with his feet in the stocks, his features changed by suffering, and expecting to be burned alive on the morrow. The poor woman sat down beside him, weeping most bitterly, while he, being hindered by his chains, could not so much as bend towards her. "I cannot set my feet to the ground," said he, "for bishops have burnt them to the bones, but they could not burn New York tongue and prevent my confessing the Lord. Oh, Elizabeth, continue to live him, for he is good, and bring up our children in his fear." On the following morning, it was Whitsunday, the brutal Chilton and his assistants led Brown to the place of execution, and fastened him to the 1719 stake. Elizabeth and Alice, with his other children and his friends, desirous of receiving his last sigh, surrounded the pile, uttering cries of anguish. The faggots were set on fire, while Brown, calm and collected, and full of confidence in the blood of the Savior, clasped his hands, and repeated this hymn, which Fox has preserved: "O Lord, I yield me to thy grace, grant my mercy for my trespass. Let never the fiend my soul chase, Lord, I will bow, and thou shalt beat, let never my soul come in hell heat." The martyr was silent. The flames had consumed their victim. Then redoubled cries of anguish rent the air. His wife and daughter seemed as if they would lose their senses. The bystanders showed them the tenderest compassion, and turned with a movement of indignation towards the executioners. The brutal Chilton, perceiving this, cried out, "Come along, let us toss the heretic's children into the flames, lest they should one day spring from their father's ashes." He rushed towards Alice, and was about to lay hold of her, when the maiden shrank back screaming with horror. To the end of her life, she recollected the fearful moment, and to her we are indebted for the particulars. The fury of the monster was checked. Such were the scenes passing in England shortly before the Reformation. The priests were not yet satisfied, for the scholars still remained in England. If they could not be burnt, they should at least be banished. They set to work accordingly. Standish, Bishop of St. Asaph, a sincere man, as it would seem, but fanatical, was inveterate in his hatred of Erasmus, who had irritated him by an idle sarcasm. When speaking of St. Asaph's, it was very common to abbreviate it into St. Ass, and as Standish was a theologian of no great learning, Erasmus, in his jesting way, would sometimes call him Episcopus a Sancto Asino. As the bishop could not destroy Colet, the disciple, he flattered himself that he should triumph over the master. Erasmus knew Standish's intentions. Should he commence in England that struggle with the papacy which Luther was about to begin in Germany, it was no longer possible to steer a middle course. He must either fight or leave. The Dutchman was faithful to his nature, we may even say, to his vocation. He left the country. Erasmus was, in his time, the head of the great literary community. By means of his connections and his correspondence, which extended over all Europe, he established between those countries where learning was reviving, an interchange of ideas and manuscripts. The pioneer of antiquity, an eminent critic, a witty satirist, the advocate of correct taste, and a restorer of literature, one only glory was wanting: he had not the creative spirit, the heroic soul of a Luther. He calculated with no little skill, could detect the smile on the lips or the knitting of the brows, but he had not that self-abandonment, that enthusiasm for the truth, that firm confidence in God, without which nothing great can be done in the world, and least of all in the church. "Erasmus had much, but was little," said one of his biographers. In the year 1517, a crisis had arrived. The period of the revival was over, that of the Reformation was beginning. The restoration of letters was succeeded by the regeneration of religion, the days of criticism and neutrality by those of courage and action. Erasmus was then only 49 years old, but he had finished his career. From being first, he must now be second. The monk of Wittenberg dethroned him. He looked around himself in vain. Placed in a new country, he had lost his road. A hero was needed to inaugurate the great movement of modern times. Erasmus was a mere man of letters. When attacked by Standish in 1516, the literary king determined to quit the court of England and take refuge in a printing office. But before laying down his scepter at the foot of a Saxon monk, he signalized the end of his reign by the most brilliant of his publications. The epoch of 1516-17, memorable for the theses of Luther, was destined to be equally remarkable by a work which was to imprint on the new times their essential character. What distinguishes the Reformation from all anterior revivals is the union of the learning with piety, and a faith more profound, more enlightened, and based on the Word of God. The Christian people was then emancipated from the tutelage of the schools and the popes, and its charter of enfranchisement was the Bible. The 16th century did more than its predecessors. It went straight to the fountain, the Holy Scriptures, cleared it of weeds and brambles, plumbed its depths, and caused its abundant streams to pour forth on all around. The Reformation Age studied the Greek Testament, which the clerical age had almost forgotten, and this is its greatest glory. Now the first explorer of this divine source was Erasmus. When attacked by the hierarchy, the leader of the schools withdrew from the splendid halls of Henry VIII. It seemed to him that the new era which he had announced to the world was rudely interrupted. He could do nothing more by his conversation for the country of the Tudors. But he carried with him those precious leaves, the fruit of his labors, a book which would do more than he desired. He hastened to Baal, and took up his quarters in Frobenius's printing office, where he not only labored himself, but made others labor. England will soon receive the seed of the new life, and the Reformation is about to begin.